Welcome back, everybody. Good to have you here with us. We are going to switch gears now and obviously talk about what happened over this weekend in Paris with all the people killed and injured. As I said, just a week earlier, the same thing happened in Lebanon, where 40-odd people were killed and over 200 wounded as well, severely wounded, and the escalation, the Russian bomber being attacked. And the world seems paralyzed in many ways to even begin to think about how to address this. We are here with Phyllis Bennis once again. It's good to have her with us, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, author of many, many books, her most recent, Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror, a primer. Phyllis, welcome back.
Great to be with you, Mark.
Dr. Taban Abdallah joins us. He was here last week when he was visiting Egypt. He's associate professor of Middle East History at York University. And his most recent books are Dictatorship, Imperialism, and Chaos, Iraq Since 1989, and A Short History of Iraq. Tabit, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hello. Good to be there.
And Sam Faddis is with us. Sam Faddis is a retired CIA operations officer, author of numerous books, including his latest, Kaffa, which was a novel. He's also running for Congress. And good to have you with us, Sam.
Great to be here, Mark.
410-319-8888. You can write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. Don't jump onto our Facebook page. It's 410-319-8888. We do seem, Sam, we haven't been on in a while, so let me start with you and we'll go around the room. We've seen that France has now attacked Raqqa, the capital of the Islamic Caliphate, or as they're calling it. I heard other reports from people who covered this, which is reading about it before it went on the air, looking at it again on the internet now, that possibly hundreds of innocent Arabs or dozens of innocent Arab civilians were killed in this bombing. We seem to be paralyzed for a strategy.
Right. I would agree with that. I think we have no strategy as to what we're doing. I think that we've ordered bombing of Syria some time ago because it gives the appearance that we are doing something. So, frankly, I would describe it as a political move rather than anything strategic.
Phyllis?
Well, I think it is a strategy. It's a failed strategy. The strategy is to respond to terrorism with war. Unfortunately, it seems President Hollande is now channeling George Bush in his decision to use this horrific attack in Paris as the basis for full-scale war, what he called merciless war, is what he's calling for and advocating, and that appears to be what he's doing. The so-called capital of the so-called Islamic State in Raqqa in Syria isn't just what ISIS declares it to be. It's a large city of somewhere around 350,000, 400,000 people who are living under the horrors of ISIS rule, the bombing by the U.S., bombing by Russia, and now bombing by France. And when they bomb a big city, that we already know they've bombed an area that includes a museum and several clinics, there will be civilian casualties. We don't have all the numbers yet, but that's inevitable when you bomb in a big city. So the problem is this is a strategy that is, one, failing everywhere else it's been tried and continuing to fail. It's failed in the past and it's failing now. And it will kill huge numbers of people, destroy towns and villages. Raqqa will probably be destroyed by the end of it. And that will lead potentially to more terrorism, because at the end of the day, terrorism survives wars. People don't.
Tabit.
I don't disagree with what has been said. I would add that I still believe that this particular evil manifestation in the Middle East, the so-called Islamic State, has to be faced with some act some military act, and I think it is imperative that there should be a broad coalition in this. What I think, what I would agree with what Phyllis said, is that if this is the only thing, if it's only limited to just bombings, and the bombings seem to be even haphazard, triggered by the terror acts that we've seen, rather than a very clear strategy, then yes, I think this is quite terrible. But I'm very, and I've said this many times. While I oppose the American invasion of Iraq, I think that the West's involvement in Yemen is very ill-advised. I do think that there must be some sort of military action against the Islamic State. And I would say, though, that while in general these kind of terrible bombings will affect innocents and might lead to increasing anger and so forth at the West, there is one aspect of this air campaign that has been successful. It has limited the spread of the Islamic State, especially in Iraq. It has also had some positive impact in regaining some cities, such as the city of Sinjar, where the aerial campaign was coordinated with Kurdish and Iraqi military forces. I think what needs to be done is that the coalition must be broadened. Turkey must be brought in. I think Iran should there should be some moves toward bringing Iran into this. There should be a much broader plan of how to invest in the region and to bring the Sunni community back in the fold. This is not easy. I completely agree. There's enormous suspicion of the West, but I am completely against the notion that the West should wash its hands of it and walk away from the region.
Phyllis, let me let you respond.
Well,
I think
the problems that Tabit has just raised are all exactly right, but I think what we face is what happens with these bombing campaigns. The city of Sinjar, from the reports we're getting, has been essentially destroyed in the bombing, so it becomes somewhat of a Pyrrhic victory. We can claim, well, ISIS has been defeated, but so have the people of Sinjar, who now have no homes to go back to. So that, to me, is not that's not the kind of solution we need. Will there ever have to be force used? Yes, I'm sure there will, and we've seen that before. The Kurdish forces across Syria and in parts of Iraq have successfully managed to take on ISIS in narrowly defined areas, in local areas. Has any individual bombing raid by the U.S. or Russia or France or whoever else is doing it? Yes, I'm sure there are occasions where a particular bombing raid helped a local Kurdish force. But the reality is the cost of those bombing campaigns, because we're not talking about that kind of very specific, very narrow, targeted bombing at a given moment. We're talking about destruction of whole cities. We're talking about engaging the U.S. in a return to the occupation of Iraq across the region. The long-term impact is going to be far worse. And I think that we have to be, I don't know what the word is, somehow modest enough pull back from the notion that our military force, the military being the one part of U.S. power that remains uncontested in the world, at a time when our economic and diplomatic and cultural and other kinds of influence is waning, the only arena in which we are unprecedentedly and really unchallenged is on the military arena. So it's not surprising that when the public demand, for all the right reasons, when there is a huge human rights crisis and there's a public demand on the government to, quote, do something, it's not surprising that what we end up with is something military, because that's the one thing the U.S. knows how to do. The rest is a lot harder. The negotiations are harder. The idea of an arms embargo in Syria, for instance, on all sides. You know, it's fine that the U.S. keeps calling on Russia and Iran to stop arming the Assad regime, but as long as they are continuing to provide the arms flowing in such huge numbers to every anti-Assad force around, from the most extreme to the supposedly secular, they have no credibility in saying that. Mm-hmm. It's going to be really hard to imagine a ceasefire with an arms embargo on the U.S. side because of the power of the arms industry's lobbies. I don't deny that. That's a huge challenge that we face. It's much harder than sending the Marines or sending the Special Forces or sending the bombers. But at the end of the day, that's going to have to be what happens. The escalation by France is simply escalating the bombing of a large city with who knows how many civilian casualties. That's not the answer to ISIS. But what I think ISIS wants right now more than anything is precisely to get a greater concentration of Western forces, ideally in their mind, ground forces, that they can attack on their turf. We should not give them what they want.
Sam, let me come in before I have some specific questions. Let me just come in on this.
Well, look, I'm the first guy, as I think you know, to say that that war is an ugly, nasty, brutish thing. So, you know, if you're going to fight a war in the middle of a city, yes, I don't care how careful you are and how much you try to adhere to the law of war. A lot of innocent people and people that you didn't intend to hurt are going to get killed. That's the reality. But, I mean, I would put it to you in these terms. ISIS is not interested in talking or negotiating with anybody. And this that you have seen in France is the end of nothing. And when you have an organization that can pull off an attack of this magnitude, which frankly was intended to be much worse because the centerpiece of this was supposed to be them getting into the football stadium, which they failed to do. When you have an organization like that that can operate in a place like France, where they are no slouches at intelligence and security, you have a real problem. And there are undoubtedly other attacks being planned, and there is no reason to think that it is not going to come here. And on some level, there are a lot of things we should do policy-wise, but we have to respond militarily. I mean, we have to destroy ISIS as an entity, or you're going to see this happen in an American city sometime very soon.
Let me ask this question. When we talk about responding militarily, and I see, and Clarence and Ernest, when I come to your calls first, who callers up, but just let me throw the ideas out because this is very complex. So I heard what you were saying earlier, Talbot, about this: if there was a war, what the coalition would have to be, which is almost impossible to put together. And so, when we talk about war, what do we mean? I mean, is it France has gone off and they are attacking Raqqa? Russia is attacking their own sites. America has their sites they're bombing. The Kurds individually with American support are going into certain parts of ISIS-held territory and regaining some land, of course.
The Syrians are just dying.
And the Syrians are dying all over the place and fleeing the country by the millions. And you've got the Kurds are hated by everybody who might be in this coalition, whether it's Turkey, Iran, or Syria. And to really address ISIS for a moment here, to wrestle with this in a military way, would mean to do what you were suggesting, but that's impossible to get there. You can't do it. How can this be done with simply air power from the West?
No, it cannot be. And my position is a bit sort of, I would say, in between that of Mr. Faddis and Ms. Bennis. I think the danger of ISIS, and I was in Iraq when ISIS was just beginning to sort of emerge. There was embryonic notions of it forming. And I'm in contact with relatives who were very close to areas where ISIS reached. And the sheer brutality, the sheer evil of this is one that, the rest of the world has a moral obligation to do something about. B, the United States played a crucial role, not the single role, but played a major role in its emergence. And now, C, this group is beginning to come to the West, actually. And so there must be a Western involvement. I think there has to be a military involvement, but it cannot be limited to that. In my opinion, the role of progressives, let's say, or of the intellectuals and activists is not to say no to American involvement, but rather to channel it in areas that it can be more beneficial. I agree that just indiscriminate bombardment of major urban areas is not the way to go. But on the other hand, even in areas where there wasn't major bombardment, I mean, this ISIS group is so brutal that, say, when the Kurds took over Kobani, the city of Kobani was also destroyed. It's not just the aerial bombardment that is doing this. So I think a very important, there are two aspects of this that need to be introduced to the West strategy of combating ISIS. We have the sort of military notion, nobody can beat the Americans in this, they're amazing, I'm sure they can draw up excellent plans for this, but there are two other things. First is the very difficult, as you say, but I don't think it's impossible, process of actually trying to build coalition with some very unsavory groups. I think Turkey needs to be brought in. Turkey has a much more of a fear of especially the Democratic Union Party of Kurdistan, which is affiliated with the PKK. And they're extremely worried, of course, about the Kurdish equation here. But I don't think it's beyond the possibility of actually bringing Turkey into such a front. I think it's very important to cooperate with Russia and through Russia to put pressure on the Assad regime so that the Assad regime will be perhaps more amiable to some sort of a settlement. I don't know if this is possible, but it's something that one should work toward. Rather than simply calling for the overthrow of the Assad regime, I think there should be a notion of a new Syria. I think Iran has to be brought in. Iran, of course, one is extremely suspicious of. And me, being an Iraqi, I know how Iranian hegemony and influence in the country has not been very positive. But they are a powerful force in the region, and to simply ignore them is a mistake. There should be a much broader role played by the United Nations. I mean, the United Envoy for Syria, Stefan de Mistura, has been sort of a bystander in all of this. And most importantly, the second element, other than building coalitions, is for a real, genuine commitment to major investments in stabilization. Not the fiasco that we saw in Iraq after the American invasion, where the post-war investment never really took place, but some sort of a real commitment on the part of the West to invest in these regions, or else it will come to haunt them. I mean, these refugees will not be stopped. I just heard the state of Alabama saying that they're not going to bring in refugees. That's not going to prevent people from coming. You must invest in this region.
So let me just say, we have to take a quick break here. I'm going to come right back. I'll let you come right back in, Phyllis, as soon as we come back from this break, and come back to Sam as well. And I think that, the three of you have a great deal to say, and articulated very well. So I mean, once in a while I may have to break in just to make sure that we get everybody inside this discussion and have it flow. But I think that this is a really critical discussion to have about how we respond. Does the military play a role? What role is that, or is that out of the equation? We're going to come right back with our three guests. We have a lot of folks calling in at 410-319-8888. Ernest and Clarence are going to come to your calls. Please stay with us. We'll come back and go right to Phyllis's thought and back to our questioning. Welcome back. We are wrestling with what the response should be with ISIS in our world with Dr. Tabet Abdallah. You just heard before we went to break, Associate Professor of Middle East History at York University in Toronto, author of numerous books, including Dictatorship, Imperialism, and Chaos in Iraq since 1989, and A Short History of Iraq. Sam Faddis, Charles Faddis, is a retired CIA operations officer. We first met on this program many, many years ago when he wrote about his efforts in Iraq, and is now author of the recent novel Kaffa, and is running for Congress here in Maryland, and Phyllis Bennis, Director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, and author of the recent book, Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terrorism, a primer, excuse me. And Phyllis, you were going to jump in and say something, then we'll go to the phones.
Yeah, just 2 points. On the question of the role of the military, I think we have to be clear that You know, when President Obama says there is no military solution, he's absolutely right. When he says the military part isn't enough, we need other things too, the problem is he's not recognizing that carrying out the military component makes much of the non-military part impossible. The example being, say you bomb in Iraq somewhere and you get an ISIS camp. Maybe you don't even get anybody else. You're lucky in that one. It almost never happens, but maybe they do. They get people who are all really bad guys, and everybody in Washington says, yay, we got the bad guys. And the response in Iraq, among Iraqi Sunnis, for instance, might be, yeah, once again, here's the U.S. bombing Sunnis in the interests of the Kurds and the Shia government. And maybe we have to start looking to ISIS to protect our interests because they're the only ones. They're lesser evil. So it's a
huge
challenge. It's not to say there's no room for anyone to use force against the terrible force and brutality of ISIS, but it means that when the U.S. does it, it pretty much ensures, one, that it's going to fail, and two, that the U.S. is going to remain. The second point has to do with this notion of ISIS in the sense of being more brutal than anybody else has ever imagined. We used to hear that all the time about al-Qaeda. Right now, al-Qaeda and its Syrian affiliate, the al-Nusra Front, is essentially operating as an ally of the United States because ISIS is even more brutal. The destruction of ISIS will not lead to everybody being secular and democratic and open-minded and all those things. It's going to lead, likely, if it's done militarily, to an even more brutal new organization that we will be hearing about next year, allying ourselves with ISIS to fight against the new guys who are even worse. So that can't be the basis to say military solutions will work because they're so terrible. It's precisely because they're so terrible that we need far more creative, far more long-lasting, and much harder non-military solutions.
Talbot, very quickly, I want to go to Sam, but you were trying to say what, then I'm going to go right to Sam with a question here and then open the phones.
Look, the Sunnis in Iraq do not have the reaction that if the United States bombs ISIS, the reaction is not going to be of the Sunnis that the United States is attacking us. What the reaction, the reason that Sunnis in Iraq feel terribly threatened is not because of this. It's because what they see as having been marginalized in the political arena, the fact that the Americans supported in a very simplistic fashion thought of Iraq as being divided into three groups and supported the Kurds and the Shias. It's not if these things are addressed, then I don't think the Sunnis would be opposed to American military involvement.
So, Sam, on the way to the phone, I'll just ask this one question. When people talk, and you talk, and mentioned the military action, I mean, military action against Islamic State, if it comes just for argument's sake, on the military issue, if that was a course, it can't just be the West. I mean, if this is the United States and France doing this, it just becomes bombing the hell out of Syria and Iraq with very little result, would be my guess.
Yeah, but it's not. I mean, the main groups that are fighting ISIS are not the West. It's the Iraqi army. It's the Kurdish groups. It's various Syrian groups. These are the main people who are fighting ISIS and dying and bleeding.
Sam?
Yeah, look, I'm absolutely never going to advocate that we should be just sort of bombing the hell out of Syria and Iraq. You're never going to get rid of ISIS that way, and you are going to kill a lot of people that you didn't intend to kill that way. I mean, it's going to take people on the ground. I don't advocate U.S. conventional military forces there. I do think there are already a number of groups fighting ISIS. I think if we had the right people there and we supported them, I think you would find that you have a lot of allies on the ground who would love to get rid of these guys who are hideous and monstrous and who are inflicting every day this kind of wholesale slaughter on people in the region that we see relatively sporadically in the West. So I don't think it's easy. I don't think it's impossible to find allies and to make this happen, but it's certainly not going to happen just by bombing people from the air. That is not the way to go.
Let me open the phone to get some thoughts from our listeners. Come right back to our guests at 410-319-8888. Ernest, you're on the air.
Yeah, good
morning.
Good morning. Yeah, well, it's terrible what happened in France, but you got to look at the history of France and Algeria's and all the Francophone countries where France has been absolutely vicious and terrible in this regard. Now, even in when Muammar Gaddafi was overthrown, he was attacking the Al-Qaeda and the French elements. He was going after them. France and the United States, Sarkozy, Hillary Clinton, Bernard Henri Lévy from France, they talked Barack Obama into destroying Libya. Hundreds of thousands of tribes that was loyal to Libya, Muammar Gaddafi, most of them were African ancestors, were slaughtered. Nobody said, I didn't see nobody crying and saying anything about that. They knew there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. You know how they knew? Because John Bolton investigated it. Ambassador John Bolton investigated and reported back to the president and Cheney and Rumsfeld. They went in there anyway and attacked those people and killed thousands of people for no reason at all.
Okay.
It's just for greed and money and things, and that's why this is going on. And I don't think nobody in those Francophone countries are having no tears about what happened in France. Even in Vietnam, they're not having tears for that. France has a terrible history of taking advantage of people. They're raping boys right now as we speak in Africa.
All right, so let me, Ernest, I hear what you're saying, and this is a point of fact. There were about 25,000 people or more who were killed in Libya. It wasn't hundreds of thousands, but that was 25,000 too many in a war that should never have happened, I think. But the reality is it wasn't just France was attacked. Beirut was attacked. In the Shiite neighborhoods in Lebanon were attacked. 40 people were killed, 200 people mauled and wounded. The Russian airliner taken down, threats against many people throughout the Muslim world, as well as threats against the West, France and U.S. I mean, this is larger than just a French issue. French just happened to be the target of the moment. Just to throw that out, I mean, the history is there. I mean, we can go back to our history, I think, Phyllis, and know where the roots of this are. I mean, this is,
right.
I think most of us may agree on that.
No, that's absolutely right. But I think the point is, if we want to stop events like this from happening, we have to look at why people support these sorts of things. It isn't enough to say, well, people, they're just sociopaths who love violence. That may be true for some people, but it isn't what makes it possible for this organization to have become so powerful, to actually seize and hold territory, to be governing somewhere between 5 and 6 million people at this point. That's a different phenomenon, and at our peril, we ignore what makes people feel like this is somehow a legitimate political action. The fact, even looking at the history of French colonialism and U.S. imperialism, still doesn't justify these kinds of attacks against civilians any more than the imperialist attack on civilians in the first place was somehow justified by any ideological or whatever campaign. But if we're serious about stopping it, we do have to understand what motivates people to support it, what motivates people to see it as legitimate. It isn't enough to just say these people are so violent that everybody in the world agrees they should be attacked. Well, not everybody in the world agrees that they are the main target. Other people have different views of who threatens them, who is the problem. And so we do have to understand these things.
But Phyllis,
colonialism is part of that.
But I'm going to go back to the other guests here and the callers. But the reality is that Most of the people inside the Arab world and the Islamic world oppose.
Absolutely.
There's a world range against them.
But if we want to stop it from happening from these small groups, this was true in 9/11, and those of us who said it on 9/12 were accused of supporting or whatever of those hijackers. Those of us who said, if we're serious about preventing this from ever happening again, we need to understand why it happened in the first place, why it wasn't enough to say, oh, they hate our freedoms, because they don't hate our freedoms. They hate the fact that, in many cases, we took away their freedoms. So, you know, you just have to understand things if you think you're going to have any chance of stopping it. It's not enough to just condemn.
So is our, and I guess, Talbot, what you're saying, from your perspective, the only way out of this is a massive war against...
Look, I don't disagree with anything that Phyllis Bennis just said. I completely agree with this, of course. My issue right now, where we might have a bit of a disagreement, is that I think that in certain instances in history, there is an overwhelming need for a broad-based coalition, a coalition that could be with groups that you have very deep disagreements with. I think the Middle East in general, the Arab peoples have very, very legitimate complaints and concerns regarding the way that the United States has behaved in the area, regarding its the destruction that it brought on Iraq, regarding the Arab-Israeli issue, regarding even the petroleum question. There are many issues that I think are very legitimate in terms of Arab complaints on the United States in particular, and the West in general with its colonial past. The colonial past is important because it means you don't trust being partners with these groups. But there are instances in history where you are forced to have a temporary alliance to deal with a more dangerous, more immediate enemy. And I think the Islamic State is one such instance. Now, I don't disagree completely with Phyllis when she says that this is an evil, and we were saying this, say, about Saddam Hussein in the past, and something even more terrible came on. This is why it's very important for progressive voices, such as that of Phyllis in the United States now, and I admire much of her work and what she's written. This is why it's important to discuss the necessity of long-term investments, of a more even-handed approach to the political disputes in the Middle East as the long-term solution to many of these problems. But there is an immediate problem right now that needs to be addressed. I mean, I mentioned this before. When the Rwanda massacres were happening and the West did nothing, everybody was up in arms saying that this was an immoral act on the West to not do anything. Why is it now even a debatable issue with respect to ISIS? They're even more horrible than what happened in Rwanda.
I'll just challenge one thing. The U.S. didn't do nothing on Rwanda. The U.S. and France actively prevented the United Nations troops who were on the ground and ready to protect that population under threat. They actively prevented them. It was far worse.
Yeah, but this doesn't change, you know, the main point I was stating here, which is the need for involvement.
So I do need to get back to phone, so I'm going to go to Sam. So, Sam, this is what I started the show with. We are paralyzed with a course of action. And, you know, it's you know, if for the argument some people are making about taking on the Islamic State, I mean, it still boggles my mind when you think about what does that mean. I mean, the other week we talked in the program here about, you know, there could be a Russian strategy before all this happened of aligning with Iran, Hezbollah, and Assad, and attacking ISIS. That was a real possibility. It may still be a possibility. But the question is, there is no – people are paralyzed in the face of what we could be facing, the continuing acts against the people in the places that they take over, the rapes, the horrific beheadings, imprisoning so many people, killing people wherever they go, forcing people to convert or die. The attacks in Sinai, the attacks in Lebanon, in France, maybe the U.S. What I'm saying is we are really paralyzed, it seems, to come up with a strategy that might even work here, partially because of what we created in the last 14 years.
Well, I mean, clearly, I think I agree with you. I think that we are paralyzed. And look, I'd never want to reduce American foreign policy to military action. Right. I mean, I may be the last guy to advocate that. I've been to a few wars. I'd be really happy if I don't ever have to go to another one. I got a son that almost died in Afghanistan as a U.S. Marine.
I remember.
I don't take any of this kind of stuff lightly. I don't think that this should be the sum total of our foreign policy. But here's the reality. These guys are not looking to redress grievances. They're not looking to discuss anything. They are an expressly religious, apocalyptic group. They believe this is the end of times, and they want to destroy not just us, not just Western nations, but all of the secular regimes of the Middle East. In fact, they probably want to kill them as apostates more than they want to kill us. That's where we are. So you can either wait for them to come do this again, or you can go get rid of this group now. Those are fundamentally your two choices, and I don't mean that to sound alarmist, but that is literally where they are and where we are. And when you see, you know, as a guy who worked counterterrorism for a long time, when I see an operation of this magnitude pulled off in the heart of Europe, it really sends chills up and down my spine, because it tells you that you have an organization that is gaining strength and capability. It is not contained. It is not rocked back. And if we don't act now, we're going to be back to responding like we were on the 12th of September, 2001. And again, I don't want that to sound hysterical, but that's the reality of where we are.
Doesn't sound hysterical, but you're calling for exactly the same thing the U.S. tried to do on the 12th of September, which was to go to war against terrorism, and it failed. It's what led to ISIS. It's what created ISIS.
But
ISIS is made up with a leadership, exactly what you define, apocalyptic, cult, etc. But the vast majority of people that are fighting with them don't even know what that analysis is. You know, it's been shown that at least some of the people going to fight with them from the UK, the books that they ordered from, somebody did a study on the books they ordered from Amazon before they went, the most common one was Islam for Dummies. You know, these are not committed extremists religiously. These are people who are, for whatever reason, looking for a way to fight back against what they perceive is their enemy. The military leadership, the training and the strategy is coming from former Ba'athist Sunni generals from Iraq, the ones who actually know how to craft a military strategy. They're not religious extremists. They're secular as could be. They drink, they smoke, you know, what? They don't believe this stuff, but they're fighting with them because they see them as the way to get back at this U.S.-backed, overwhelmingly Shia-dominated government in Baghdad. So it's not, this is not, you know, thousands of extremists on believing all of this sort of apocalyptic end of days stuff. That's the leadership line. But there's really no evidence that the people going off to fight with them from the region and beyond have any connection to that.
I promise, Lenson, we open the phones here. But I mean, Phyllis, I do want to ask this question. We'll come back to this next caller. That, I mean, is there, are you positing that we can deal with ISIS without military action?
I'm positing that our military action, I'm saying, has made things worse and not better, and will continue to do so. That doesn't mean that I don't agree that people living under their rule, the Kurds, et cetera, have the right to fight back against them. Of course they do. Mm-hmm. But the question of what of making this a U.S. war, the way we made Iraq a U.S. war, Afghanistan a U.S. war, Libya a U.S. NATO war, they've all failed, and this is going to result in the same thing. I think that we need to stop the access that ISIS and others have to their weapons. That means we've got to deal with the Saudis, who, by the way, behead people on a regular basis because that's their usual means of capital punishment, which they impose for things like witchcraft and apostasy. But we don't seem to find that so terrible. They're still our closest Arab ally in the region. So, you know, this, I'm not saying that we can deal with ISIS directly, militarily or not. It's not in our country right now where the core of it is. As much as we try to bomb or militarily attack ISIS and destroy it, we will give rise to the next ISIS, the next generation.
Phyllis, you are partially responsible for it being there. And when you say let the Kurds and the Iraqis fight them, they need help. And the reason they need help is because partly because the United States has weakened these governments to such an extent. America has a moral obligation
to
be involved and to assist militarily,
not just to assist
with nice words and
things
like
that.
One at a time.
Anyway, there's another thing that we have to... I mean, I don't know if we're going to reach any kind of an agreement here.
I think
we've all sort of, you know, articulated our opinion. But there's another issue here that I think is extremely important to bring up, Mark. And this is the reaction in the West to what has happened in France. I'm really glad you mentioned Beirut. There was another also ISIS bombing in Turkey several months ago.
And in Afghanistan.
But the reaction in
Afghanistan,
the thing that I think would benefit ISIS the most is if there is this right-wing anti-immigration, anti-foreigner reaction that will actually make recruitment for them much easier. It will be it will bolster their ideological platform of there being an incurable hostility between the West and Islam. And we are seeing incredible signs of this, not just in Europe, but even in the United States, where there is quite a bit of noise being made now about what is it? Only 10,000 refugees? Really, a drop in the bucket compared to what the United States
can
absorb.
This one we agree with. I absolutely agree with you.
So, and I think that's another piece of issue we have to talk about later this week as well. I mean, I think that you're seeing that reaction, and because that wave of refugees from the Middle East is not going to stop. Let me come back to that point. I promise my listeners to get to the phones. Let me get these two quick calls in here. 410-319-8888. Clarence, you're on the air.
Thank you, Mr. Steiner. Normally when I hear the word coalition, I take a deep breath. But this coalition that you're talking about, I believe, is absolutely necessary. A lot of us liken this to Vietnam, bomb them back into the Stone Age, where you had a lot, huge loss of life, but you never paid attention to the history of that country that was destroyed. A lot of us out here now, we view any bomb dropped in the Middle East as a crime against humanity. So you have to go in, if they're that evil, which I agree, you have to go in with boots on the ground and do not destroy all of the historical sites along with the loss of life in that part of the world. That part of the world is more important than any political ideology and anything else. You do not destroy that by bombing them. You have to send the troops in on the ground, prevent the loss of life as much as you can, but do not destroy that country with bombs, that part of the world. Thank you.
So let me ask, before we try to call her in here, let me get her in, then I'm going to kind of ask you to each close up with a thought I'm going to ask you. And Donna, you're on the air. Very quick thought. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yes. My question is, when all this started many, many years ago, you had families that were destroyed, you know, children who were suffered the post-traumatic stress disorder. And it seems like these organizations, ISIS, is preying on these children who are suffering from, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder to recruit them. And that's including all around the world. My question is, what mental health organizations around the world are also looking at the mentality of ISIS? Are they psychosocial paths? What and how do we address it from that perspective as well? And I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks, Donna. Our guests can address that in their kind of final comments if they'd like. Because I am also looking at this, and when I hear the world leaders talk about what they're talking about, I don't see any of them coming up with any kind of strategy that's going to work. I'm curious what we think is about to unfold. And I know you're not prescient. I'm not, but I think about this a lot, just watching what's happening here. And talking to friends back and forth in the Middle East as well. Sam, let me start with you. I mean, how do you think this is going to unfold?
Well, unfortunately, if you're asking me what I think is going to happen, is that we are going to hold course, which means we're not really going to do anything materially different strategy-wise. And at the risk of sounding really depressing, that in the near term, it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better.
Talbot?
I think I agree with this. I don't think there's any kind of a clear, determined effort to really get rid of ISIS. But I'm not completely sure that there's no strategy. I think the strategy is containment. You know, and over time, I believe that this group cannot really survive, that it will implode from within. But unfortunately, it's going to be drawn out, and unfortunately, mm-hmm. many, many more people will suffer before this happens.
Phyllis?
I think there is a strategy to channel the words of George Bush and make this the basis for a war, both in France and continuing in the U.S. I think containment probably is the ultimate goal, but we don't get to call the shots that way. I think this is a strategy that has failed in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Libya. It's failed everywhere it's been used, and it's failing now in Syria, and it's going to continue to fail. The proxy wars in Syria will continue. People will die to the last Syrian in these wars. But I'm afraid that the range of non-military solutions is not going to move fast enough. The one opportunity that we have is the Vienna talks, which I think are very important. I would disagree slightly with the notion that the UN has been largely AWOL. I think that the work of Stephen de Mistura has been very important in creating...
Sorry, we just lose Phyllis. Oh, something happened. Just went dead. The phone, I mean to say. But I do want to thank our guests. This has really been great. We will come back to this.
You have to choose your words carefully.
I know. I meant the phone line went dead. I apologize. I want to thank the three of you so much. This has been a really engaging discussion because we really have to range in what's happening here in our communities about where we go next and what the options are. I think we are entering a very frightening moment in our world history. And we'll see where this takes us. And I want to thank Sam Faddis, as always, for joining us. Been great to have you as a continuing guest on the show. Good luck on the campaign trail, former CIA operations officer and a great writer. Sam, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Tabet Abdallah joins us once again from York University in Toronto, author and deep thinker. And Tabet, always great to have you with us. Thank you so much, my friend.
Thank you. Thank
and
you.
I want to thank Phyllis Bennis, whose phone line went dead, but she always adds so much to the conversations with her thoughts and ideas from the Institute for Policy Studies. And thank you all for writing and calling in and for making this show what it is. These are very tough subjects we dealt with today, but that's what we do and that's what we have to do. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineers, Andre Melton. Our interns are Sianna Grease, Manifa Wilson, and Calvin Perry, who's with us today. Our theme music is by Juan Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. And to podcast the Mark Steiner Show, share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org, or listen to us on your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM. The voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.